This is The Radical Therapist, a space where we explore the intersections of collaborative therapy, philosophy, art, and science and technology in a post-Freud, post-psychology world.
Welcome to The Radical Therapist. This is your host, Chris Hoff, and we are now at episode number 55. As always, we're very excited about this episode. Finally get a chance to talk to somebody. I was hoping to talk to probably when I originally started this podcast because I used, Dr. Chris Donahue, but I used his first book, Sex Outside the Lines, as a textbook when I taught sex therapy. So I've been a fan for a while, but he has a new book out now, Rebel Love, Break the Rules, Destroy Toxic Habits, and Have the Best Sex of Your Life. Just came out. Everybody should get it. Link will be in the show notes. But before we get to Dr. Chris, I got a couple of quick announcements. My friend and colleague, Justine DiRigo-Patrick, and myself are going to be doing a live interview on tctv.live, therapeuticconversationstv.live. on February 28th at 9 a.m. Pacific time. And if you're interested in narrative therapy or all things narrative therapy, I would encourage you to check out tctv.live. And they do a regular schedule of live interviews of folks really all over the world talking about different aspects of the practice of narrative therapy. And Justine and I are going to be doing a little talk on social, it's called Beyond Deconstruction, post-structural social justice, and it's going to be kind of a prelude to a longer presentation we'll be doing at the Therapeutic Conversations in Vancouver in May. So if you're going to Vancouver in May, reach out to me. I might be trying to pull together a little radical therapist get together while we're there, but Justine and I will also be doing a more expanded version of what we're going to be talking about on February 28th at 9 a.m. And it'd be great if you could join us. That would be awesome. And also wanted to let you know, I have a new YouTube video up on the Radical Therapist YouTube channel, launched last week, called The Four Ways of Knowing, where I kind of delve into an article that Craig Smith wrote on relational attunement, where he talks about the work of Tom Anderson, and a specific piece of that article has been really influential in my work around the four ways of knowing and how that influences us as clinicians, what gets privileged in the therapy room and what probably should get privileged in the therapy room that isn't. And I think you'll find that video very informative. So if you're interested in, I'm going to be doing more series of practice videos or just kind of talking about ways of being in therapy and lots of other subjects, but this is up, Radical Therapist on YouTube, Four Ways of Knowing, and I'm going to be doing a video this week, launching a video this week on the socially constructed genogram, so you might want to look out for that too. So go to the YouTube channel, please like, subscribe, comment, share, that would be great. And of course, we're on all other social media, Instagram, Facebook. We have a website, theradicaltherapist.com, and we're on Twitter at theradtherapist. So find us there. That would be great. But now let's talk about our guest. Very excited to have Chris Donahue on, Dr. Chris Donahue. Dr. Chris is an international lecturer, therapist, and educator. Dr. Donahue is the director of clinical education for the Sexual Health Alliance and the host of the relaunched Loveline nightly radio show. And if there's any other Gen Xers out there, we are all very familiar with Loveline, the iconic Loveline show, and I'm sure as others are, not just the Gen Xers, but we kind of grew up on that show. And then he's also the co-host of the Amber Rose Show with Dr. Chris, a podcast, and a frequent co-host on the Doctor's TV show. Previously, Dr. Chris hosted Logo's Bad Sex and has appeared everywhere, really, from the New York Times to Nightline, Vice, Today, Newsweek, CNN, OWN, Refinery 29, and Access Hollywood, and is just kind of all over the place, doing a lot of wonderful work. And so without further ado, let's meet Dr. Chris Donahue. All right. Welcome to the Radical Therapist podcast, Dr. Chris.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. Before I get rolling on your new book, Rebel Love, Break the Rules, Destroy Toxic Habits, and Have the Best Sex of Your Life, I want to acknowledge another book you wrote, the first book, Sex Outside the Lines. And I just wanted to let you know personally that I really appreciated that book. I actually taught sex therapy at the graduate level for therapists, and I used it as a textbook because I couldn't find anything else like it. So
thank you. That means a lot. I wrote that for that very reason. I wrote it partly for myself. I needed some kind of resource, and speaking at universities, a lot of students were saying that some of the topics I'd come out and present on just weren't being addressed. But I want to thank you for your podcast, because I found your podcast when I was looking for community and resources for people that were thinking, I guess, radically, in terms of like a social justice lens and trying to kind of push on the boundaries. So thank you.
Awesome. Thanks. Yeah, I really, and the students really appreciated the perspective and the work. And so thank you for that. But you have a new book out, and that's what we're here to talk about. And I guess I want to start this, in the new book, you start with the claim that most dating advice now is outdated and oppressive. And I'm wondering if you could say more about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I have the blessing, I say that lovingly, of working on different platforms with different populations. And whether it's in my clinical office here in Los Angeles or just out on the road, I'm constantly hearing people getting hung up on these dating myths. And they're just not challenged or unpacked. And they definitely leave out anyone who sits outside of that norm. And, you know, in our culture, the norm is cis, white, hetero, family-centric, and I wanted to just be one of those voices, and I wanted my book just to kind of hold space, that there's other perspectives, other ways of doing things, ways that might be way more sustainable, but also, again, just to kind of normalize creativity and diversity in terms of sex and dating, which is inherently, I think, kind of become my entire career goal. Mm-hmm. But basically, in short, a lot of the advice that's out there is really rooted in this, I guess we could call like a capitalistic perspective upon relationships, where it's about just trying to get something, and it's trying to get the best. And it really misses out on the idea that relationships and sexuality are really about personal transformation. And they're really beautiful vehicles for learning about ourselves, but also a way to be a part of changing the world. Mm. One of my messages is this idea that every time you're sexual with someone, no matter how anonymous, no matter how quick it is, that you're always impacting the other person. So that's kind of like a thread throughout the whole thing. But basically, a lot of the points are, you know, we definitely think still in terms of the binary, sure, that everyone's a man or a woman. You're one or the other. We definitely think in terms of like dating being about getting someone. And so a lot of my clients struggle with really assessing what do they want or being authentic. You know, we live in a culture where you're told you need to be something other than you are. We see that with commercials, social media. So when people go on dates, they often enter thinking, what do I need to do to get this person? Or what do I need to do to get this person to want me or like me? And I say to people, it's the opposite. Go on the date completely and authentically as yourself. Don't hold yourself accountable to gender norms. Don't act like a lady. Don't act like a man. Go as yourself. Assess actual compatibility. And the success of a date might actually be that you realize you aren't compatible because you did show up as yourself. So tied into all that, so complex in my mind, is this whole idea, again, just within that one example, that there's so much woven in there. You know, people are afraid to express their sexuality because if you're female identified, will you be seen as wife material and respectable? And guys are, you know, buckling under these toxic masculine ideals as to how a guy's supposed to be. Yeah. And it's just not the goal of sex and dating.
Yeah, that's great. And I really liked your piece in the book about dating to be known rather than getting something. And people should absolutely read that. So, okay. So in an effort to combat this toxic messaging we've all been steeped in, right? You present a set of touchstones that kind of start the book. And I was wondering if we could go through them and have you say a bit about each one of them, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
The first is people are diverse and it's time to embrace that.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. I was just speaking yesterday at a university to the master's students in psychology. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things I was trying to kind of call out to them, that a lot of what they've been learning thus far and a lot of what people are encountering out in the world, again, is this whole idea that we can talk in broad sweeping notions about people, and that you can say, oh, women want this. And I was pointing out to them that psychology operates that way, therapy operates that way, self-help books operate that way, mm-hmm. that we can speak universally and ubiquitously about these different identities, as though saying something like people of color or a woman is going to cover everything. And so it's this whole idea that within each label we might have, there's such diversity and creativity within that. And so we have to kind of expand beyond that. It's also me always trying to talk to social media and advertisers too, because that has become such an important part of our mental health. I mean, there was a time when it was school and family that were the number one socializers, and now it's social media and media. I mean, the amount of time that we spend bathing our psyches in these things. And so I call that out as well, that there's different genders, there's different races, ages, backgrounds, sexualities, body types. And I'm always all about having my clients and people I work with redefining those things. And so just, it's that idea that we have to kind of see people as bigger than these minor labels that we tend to hold them to.
That's great. Okay. And next, there's our, and I'm really curious about this one. I really appreciate it. There's no more dating rules or sex rules, period.
Oh, yeah, this is a hard one. So I do a radio show and I do a podcast, and we get caller questions, and they tend to fall under those, you know, how soon is too soon to text someone?
Right.
When should I text them back? And I say to them the same answer to everything. How soon should you text them? When you want to. How soon should you have sex? When you want to. How soon should you see them again? As soon as you want to. It's this whole idea that the way you operate is acceptable. There's no right way to date. And again, it's all about authenticity. You know, I bring in my own self into these examples at times where I'll say, I like a lot of closeness and intimacy. So I want to, from the door, if I'm interested in someone or in a relationship with someone, I text them nonstop.
That's great.
And I do that because I want to assess, is this person wanting the same level of closeness and intimacy I do? That's all about compatibility and chemistry. So I tell people, don't try to look for some fixed rule that, again, is going to quote unquote help you get this person, because that's not accurate. That's not honest. You have to kind of get rid of all these rules and these games that we play. And so that's kind of what that one's rooted in.
Great. And self-acceptance is everything. Can you say more?
Yeah. Again, it's that's probably the biggest goal I have for everyone I work with in 2019, is this whole idea that we have to get back to how we are and who we are is okay. And that it's not new year, new you. It's new year, learn to love you as you are. Because I work with so many people that will say, as soon as I lose weight or get to the certain body type I need to have, then I'll start dating. Or as soon as I get that new job. And I want everyone to feel desirable as they are, because these future-oriented things that are supposed to give us confidence might never happen, nor may they might not even give you that anyway. And so it's this whole piece of really moving away from what you think you need to do to be respectable or desirable, and really kind of tapping back into who you are. There's too much slut-shaming, body-shaming, ageism, you know, how old is too old to date someone, how much sex is too much sex, and again, it's this idea that there's some right way and that I have to be a certain way to be acceptable and healthy. And I really think the work is about moving away from that and just saying, what are you truly attracted to? Mm-hmm. What amount of sex really makes sense to you? And let's work on feeling confident in that versus shaming the way you are and having this bizarre ideal. Like I literally have been in supervisions with interns, and I hear other therapists saying things like, it should only be this amount of age difference between two people. Otherwise, the one person clearly has an intimacy disorder, or they're too primitive in their functioning and unable to relate to people their age. And we just always enter with this pathology-based mindset when we see something creative and diverse versus just really seeing the health in that. So it's kind of about pointing that piece out.
That's great. Yeah. Okay, and I wonder if you get any pushback on this one, but anonymous sex can be a relationship in and of itself.
yeah, that's definitely one of the more punchy ones. you know, it's the idea that we have these visions of what makes something legitimate in terms of sex and relationality, and it's just not true that sometimes a one-night stand something super anonymous can sometimes be a very healing, nourishing experience. Mm-hmm. Again, we live in a culture that's telling everyone you have to have a full head of hair. You have to be a certain height. Right. You have to be a certain weight, all these different things. And the most powerful force sometimes to let us feel desirable is sexuality. And so, yes, I do work with some clients that their goal therapeutically is to go out and have more sex, because that is how we work through shame. That is how we work through body and sexual shame, is exposure, is learning to see desirability reflected back. Anonymous sex is still meaningful. You're still learning consent and boundaries and communication and sexual negotiation. There's so much therapeutic value in that. So for the people that are listening that want to have anonymous sex, find the meaning and value in that, but check in with yourself. You know, what is this? What's in this for me? But even for the therapist, you know, people will say to me, you know, you specialize in sex therapy, so you do a lot of therapy on sex. And I say to them, yes, but I also help people learn how to use sex therapeutically, because there's a multitude of ways and it's never discussed.
That's great. Yeah. Okay. I'm very curious about this one as well. Self-help is selfish.
Yep. Another zinger. I'm a big fan of this, pushing the buttons. We live in a hyper-narcissistic individualist culture, and I see that in the couples and in the marital therapy I do, where it's me versus them. It's what I want, what I need, and people aren't thinking enough in terms of community-based values or the idea that a relationship is somewhat of a regression backwards into a fusion. I believe a relationship is an us and a we. I definitely operate from a codependent model, and I talk about that more in my first book. But I want that. And so a lot of self-help is so focused on what do I need for myself? And if you really get into the Eastern philosophical components of it, it often is such a place of privilege for one to be able to do self-help work, because it kind of implies I can take a break from the world and I don't need to unpack or pay attention to institutional or systemic issues. And I'm just going to sit on my meditation cushion and work on myself. And congrats, that's awesome. love your privilege. But I think we need to think more systemically. And I think the real work is about how's the world impacting me? How am I impacting the world? And kind of unpacking that. And so I talk a lot about, it's not self-esteem, it's really about relational esteem. We don't need self-help, we need relational help. Yeah. We're relational beings, right? We constantly are within relationships. Even when we're not physically present in one, we are emotionally and psychologically present in them. And that's really what our goals are, is how to be better people out in the world and with others and in relationship. And so I think, you know, self-help, being single, there's value in that work, but the real work is done when you enter relationships and have reflected back to you who you are and how you are. And I think that's where the gold is. Mm-hmm. So I'm always telling people, think more relationally.
Yeah. And I think even in my own relational experience would, absolutely confirm that as well. Finally, your final one is, your sexuality is fluid.
Yeah. That's another good one.
Right.
You know, our culture is so sex phobic, and what would our sexualities truly be if we did live in some kind of vacuum and we didn't have to worry about slut shaming, sex phobia, homophobia? You know, my own childhood experience was one where when I was running around with my heterosexual friends, no one ever said, hey, have you ever considered being with someone of the same gender? And then when I'm running around with my gay friends, they never said, hey, when's the last time you were with a woman? Mm. We really get trapped and rooted in the subcultures and the identities that we're socialized with or make the most sense to us. But everyone's sexuality is far more fluid than they think it is. And I see that constantly in my practice, where when I do sexual histories, you see how there's an evolution and a plasticity where, as a kid, an underwear catalog might be the most arousing thing you've ever seen. Mm-hmm. But as you progress and you have new sexual experiences, it starts to expand. And that's such a beautiful, powerful thing. And that's what I tell people, every time you have a new partner, you're essentially a virgin again, because you don't know who they are. You don't know who you will be sexually while with and under the influence of this new person. Be open to that. Be open to exploring things that you might see in fantasy and porn. How can you maybe bring some of those elements into real life? Because those are sites where we can really learn about our most authentic sexual self, and just hold space for that. You know, again, if we got out of sexism and homophobia, I think people would be more open to exploration, but a lot of people aren't, because of what it will mean, you know, for women. Right. If you're hetero, and then a woman has the same sex experience, we'll let her circle back and be hetero again. But if a guy is with a guy, you are gay for life. You're not allowed to come back into the heterosexual fold. That scares guys. So it's just about trying to undo that and allow space for people to kind of be more fluid, explore things. But again, having done this work for almost 2 decades, I'm constantly watching people learn more about themselves sexually and uncover things that they had no clue even existed for them.
That's great. Can you share with our listeners kind of the thread throughout your book is sex positivity. And I wonder if you could share with our listeners what sex positivity is and why you think we should be having more sex earlier.
Yeah, so sex positivity essentially is really about mental health. It's this idea that you're okay as you are as a sexual being, regardless of what you're attracted to. That conversation isn't yet moving in terms of like how you engage things. The entry point is just, I want people to have a reduction in shame around what turns them on. Mm. The bigger, more global perspective of that is it's also how you live in the world amongst others. Being sex positive isn't about having lots of sex. You can be sex positive while taking a break from sex, while being in a monogamous relationship, while having very vanilla sex. It's just about the attitude and relationship you have to sexuality, yours and other people's. So it's about letting people have the sex they want to have and not shaming them. That's being sex positive. It's allowing yourself to be where you are sexually. That's sex positive. I look at my own sexual history. Mm-hmm. There are times where I'm very, very hypersexual. Mm-hmm. I accept that and allow that. I don't pathologize that. There are times where I'm completely more asexual. I don't shame that. I allow that. There are times where I'm more solo sexed, which means I want sex with myself and not with other people. Mm-hmm. I allow that. There's times where I'm more fetish based and I'm really seeking non-human based things where they involve human beings, but I might be more centered on a specific experience. Mm-hmm. And it's not really about the people. It's just about allowing, and it's allowing other people to engage in the sex that makes sense to them. So again, it's about an attitude and a perspective, and the meaning in that and why it's about mental health is because our sexuality is such a core part of our sense of self-worth and value. And if we're not feeling solid in that, we can't feel solid in much of anything in our lives. You can't have full-on self-esteem if you don't feel good about your sexual parts, because our sexuality is everything. My sexuality and everyone else's is what we put on in the morning to leave the house wearing. It's how close in line we stand to someone when we're waiting to get our coffee. It's eye contact we make or don't make. It's the way we relate to people, speak to people, the things we're fantasizing about. We're constantly being oriented towards things that are attractive to us. I mean, our sexuality is always in operation. It's so ubiquitous and pervasive.
Okay, you've been very critical of ideas like sex addiction and porn addiction. Is there such a thing?
Yeah, so this is the debate that I think at some point at the end of this year I'm going to stop engaging in. It's slowly starting to burn me out, the debate. It's such a hot button for so many people. Right. But basically, you know, I spent 3.5 years being trained under the forefathers and the big names in the sex addiction field. A lot of them are out here in California. And what was coming up for me initially was super smart in so many ways. And I was seeing a lot of people get some healing, but I was also being trained and supervised to pathologize things that me and my friends, all very healthy, successful, happy people, some of the things that we were doing. Because the sex addiction model, which is really the basis of why the sex addiction diagnosis is a problem, the treatment model very much sees any diverse creative forms of sexuality, pornography use, sex with trans individuals, kink, paying for sex, sex for entertainment, sex for self-soothing, all these things that are legitimate and healthy, it's seeing them as components of an addiction. And it essentially shames them and then walks people into a true sexual anorexia and sex phobia. And so I work with these clients now that come to me because they've done the sex addiction model and they're realizing I'm so detached from my sexuality. My life has less joy. And I want to learn how to engage these things without shame because they're a core part of who I am, but I've just been trained instead therapeutically to be afraid of them and avoid them. And so I kind of left the sex addiction world and got trained in sex therapy. It was about a 5-year process, and it was just so illuminating to actually take a health-based spin and really look at what the value of these different pieces. And so I was trained to not use sex therapeutically. I now do. So when a client says, I masturbate in order to self-soothe or to deal with my emotions, great. It's just another right brain activity. You know, it's like doing yoga or going for a hike or meditating. Masturbation is a form of that. If you look at the neurological studies and the brainwave studies, you'll see that they're very similar states of relaxation. And so these are just as legitimate, but the sex addiction model is really built in and made from people that are very, very sex phobic. And so it's quite toxic. But bigger than that, every single mental health organization has rejected it. You know, the DSM, both APAs, ASECT, TASHRA, it's just not legit. And so when we talk about these terms, we're not even using universally accepted operational definitions. So when we're slinging that word around, we're not even all talking about the same thing. So can people have problematic sexuality? Absolutely. Can masturbation, porn use, and sexuality feel compulsive? Absolutely. Do some people need to learn to find more of a balance? Yes. But can you be addicted? No. And is the treatment model that's currently used problematic? Absolutely.
Got it. Okay. And you even...
Because I also say this, just really quickly, I always like to throw this in. Yeah. You know, when we work with drugs and alcohol and other forms of addiction, you see people that literally cannot stop, and they'll show up in our offices high or drunk, driving. I've never had someone show up in my office still masturbating or having sex. Mm. You don't see that at Whole Foods or at Starbucks, because it's difficult to stop, but we can. And so that's also that little bit of a switch that we have to kind of weave in there.
Yeah. Okay. All right. In the book, you say good sex is ethical sex. And I'm wondering, how can we be more ethical in our sex?
Yeah, we have so much work to do. And I think such an important value is that every time you have sex with someone, you are impacting them. You are leaving an imprint on them. It's never, quote unquote, just sex. It's always some form of relational experience. And when we have sex with someone, we want to walk away feeling better. I always say that sex is supposed to have components of fun and joy and nourishment, entertainment, connection, intimacy, whatever it is, but they're all supposed to be positive. And so if you're having sex that makes you walk away feeling bad before, during, or after, check in about why. Should you not be having sex then or with that person? We don't do enough of that. How do I feel before? How do I feel during? Do I want to stop? How do I feel afterwards? Should I not go back to that? But then also the other perspective is, how you're impacting other people. Don't have sex with people in ways that might harm them. And it's kind of the consent conversation, which is, it's not enough anymore. And if you're wanting to be very ethical, to just have sex with people that are open to having sex, I also want people to think, how is this going to impact them as well? They might say yes, but if I think it's going to make them feel worse, or I'm not really sure, I want people to not do it. So it's like this whole consent and compassion. I want people to consider the impact they have on other people way more than we have. I want people to think, I want everyone who engages with me on any relational level, including sex, to walk away feeling better in the world. That yes, people can be trusted. That yes, sex is good or healthy. We have to stop wounding each other with our sexuality. And a big part of that's also online dating, where the conversation in psychology now has to be about these dating and sex apps, because there are hundreds of thousands of people using them. The millennials almost exclusively only use them for dating. And so I talk to people about ethics online, that it's not just some online random person. It's a human being. You're impacting them. Take that into consideration. Don't ghost people and disappear. End relationships lovingly. Don't burn them down. So much more compassion and ethics needed than all of the dating sex that we're doing.
Got it. That's great. Okay. In the book, and I really appreciate this, you take on toxic ideas around bodies and diet culture, and I'm wondering if you could say more about that.
Yeah, I have, you know, again, I live in Los Angeles, and so that's taken into account, but this comes up with callers from around the country. Anymore, no one's allowed to feel okay as they are. It's so difficult in our current culture to feel okay in the body you have, even if you quote-unquote meet the standards that many have defined as a good body or the sought out body, you're still then held hostage by needing to maintain and keep that, to keep that level of high market value or desirability. And those that aren't aligning with that are made to feel less than, or like they're lazy or they're doing something wrong. And so I'm constantly trying to remind people that all bodies are good bodies. All bodies are beach bodies. The gym isn't about aesthetics. It's about how you feel. Don't hide your body. There's shame is reduced in exposure and presentation. And so I tell people, you know, Don't cover yourself up. Get more comfortable wearing things that make sense to you. Don't dress, quote unquote, for your body type. Dress for what feels comfortable and looks good to you. So just moving away from this whole idea that there's one specific kind of body that we need to have to feel okay. But in the way that it translates into therapy practice, though, we can't anymore make it an individualized, privatized issue as though there's something psychically wrong and me and my client can solve it once a week in our office for an hour.
Yeah.
It's a social systemic issue. And so the therapy has to look at how can we start to chisel away and look at that cultural piece. So I have my clients hitting it on every level. I mean, we're doing the individual therapy weekly, but I know that they're still going back out into a body shaming culture. And so when they're hating their body, it's not an intrapsychic issue. So I talk to them about finding community. I talk to them about joining organizations that are about fat rights and health at every size. I have them reading the right materials. I have them unfollowing things on social media that reflect back that you have to look a certain way. I have them not reading magazines with these problematic ads that are saying you need to lose 10 pounds, new you, new year. You know, people have to chisel it away on every level. It just can't be one-on-one in our office. There's something wrong with you. There's a lot of illness in our culture around this. And so when I lecture, I also talk to the therapists that I train. I'm the clinical director for the Sexual Health Alliance, and we train doctors, nurses, and therapists, and all sorts of people that want to get an understanding of like sexuality and sex therapy. And the one thing I say to them is we have to be therapist activists. Like, it's 2019. Therapists have to become activists. I don't agree that therapy is not political. Therapy is 100% political. We use CBT as the gold standard. That's political. It's saying there's something wrong with your thinking. There's something wrong with you. It's victim blaming. It ignores systemic issues that we're impacted by. It is political. It's political as hell. Every therapist has their politics. It's just some of them are more blatant than others. I'm a feminist. I'm about queer theory. I'm sex and body positive. Mine are blatant. We all have them. But therapists need to be activists. We can't just sit in our offices, work with our clients. We have to use our social media. We have to be active out in the culture. We have to, you know, work on changing psychology. I think therapists should have blogs and podcasts. We have to do more than just sit in our offices helping one person at a time. It's just like a little band-aid. So I'm always trying to challenge people to do more and do bigger.
That's great. And that's a great way to possibly end. But before we end, could you leave us with a couple of tips or steps for our best sex ever?
Yeah, that's a big question.
Yep, sorry.
Number one, I guess I always tell people it's just about, again, authenticity. And what does that mean? It means that we tend to really constrict, water down, and quiet down. And our best sexuality is going to be engaging our totality. So I say to people, are you having the kind of sex you want to have? Ask for it. Seek it. Mm. Let yourself make noises. You know, let your body make the sounds it wants to make. Vocalize. Engage your whole body. Let your body look ugly. Let your body move around. Good sex is often sometimes messy. Don't be afraid of body fluids. It's about releasing, not constricting and thinking, how do I look? Am I doing it right? You're missing out on the core, which is pleasure, fun, and connection. And so don't get tied to that. There is no right way. So that's like the number one thing I say. But number two, to have good sex, you have to feel confident with the topic. And so work on your body positivity, work on your sex positivity, work on really addressing and unpacking whatever it is that you think is bad or wrong about sexuality. Do more research, work through those things. Don't shame yourself. Don't shame other people. See the therapeutic value of it all. Sex is often just disregarded as something you do sometimes in your bedroom with another person. And that's just not true. Our sexuality, like I said, is always in play. It's always with us. Be aware of that. And I guess in closing, it's also just be more ethical. Be more compassionate and aware of how we're impacting other people, especially within our sexuality.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Thank you. Okay, so I know people are going to want to know more about you, find you. You're on a lot of different platforms. How would people find you?
So a couple things. My Instagram is at Dr. Donahue. My Twitter's at Chris Donahue. And then I host Loveline. It's a nightly radio show. Again, the iconic Loveline. That's on radio.com, streaming. And then I also have a weekly podcast on Podcast One called The Amber Rose and Dr. Chris Show. And then my new book, Rebel Love.
Yep. And I'll link it on the show notes, and people, please pick it up.
Yeah,
yeah, I will. And you all, listeners, pick it up, buy the book. So, Dr. Chris, thank you so much. This has been a great conversation.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it. Yep.
Awesome. It's great to meet you.
Yep. Thanks, Chris. Well, that's our show. And as always, thanks for listening. I hope you got a lot out of that. Please, if you haven't, I mean, I would check out both his books, but for sure get the new book, Rebel Love, Break the Rules, Destroy the Toxic Habits, and Have the Best Sex of Your Life. And he also, his first book, which I highly recommend as well, is Sex Outside the Lines, Authentic Sexuality in a Sexually Dysfunctional Culture. Both books are, if you're any kind of clinician, you should probably have both these books on your shelf, or at least read them both, please. So hopefully you found that helpful, informative. I love doing them. Please, if you have any questions, reach out to me at theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. Find me on all the social media, on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and on Facebook. Just come find me. Come be part of the community. It would be great to have you aboard. That's it for me. As always, my name is Chris Hoff, and this has been The Radical Therapist. Thanks for listening.